Osiris.
Even though as an adult, Eno has that classic evolved type personality, once he steps in a room with his boy mates, he reverts right back to the ostrich feather wearing freaky young man that is incapable of grasping the adult that he became. And so can't do that smooth oblique strategies thing with you guys because you guys are mates.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the psychology of it was hilarious, really.
Welcome to Discograffiti, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with 3 to 4 episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. Each new guest swings a hard left into an area you either had no idea you needed to know about or know all about and can't believe you're not alone out there. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on early Eno era Roxy music. Psst. Along with our very special guest, Phil Manzanera himself, in an interview that focuses on the groundbreaking first 5 years of his tenure with glam rock legends Roxy Music. Over the course of this interview, we discuss the real story behind how Phil acquired that bug-eyed glasses look, the decidedly unweird song with which Phil initially auditioned for Roxy, and why exactly he primarily connects mainly with the first 3 Roxy Music albums. This show is as is, but most of our shows run a heck of a lot longer, and you can get longer versions on our Patreon. Heck, even if the idea of spending money is anathema to you, just head on over there because it's finally free to become a basic member. Coming up, we've got Robert Schneider rating the Strawberry Alarm Clock, the Lemon Twigs, oh, and Michelle Phillips, along with Mamas and Papas biographer Richard Campbell rating everything they ever did. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then. I don't know if you know about my show, but I typically do really in-depth discographical trawls that involve going through an artist's entire discography and rating everything. For instance, I just did a 20-hour interview with Michelle Phillips. So
wow.
When Carice said, you can have 30 minutes with Phil, I was like, okay, how am I going to truncate, especially because you guys were a very seminal influence for me. So to try to collapse it all into that.
Yes.
I've got my work cut out for me. So if you don't mind, let's.
Yeah, jump in.
Our guest tonight, towards whom I've felt thick, undulating waves of gobsmacked reverence since I became aware of his presence on a fateful, life-changing night in the fall of 1989, is a guitarist, songwriter, and producer. He is, of course, the lead guitarist with Roxy Music and also co-wrote alongside Brian Ferry such classic Roxy Music songs as Amazona, Out of the Blue, Prairie Road, Whirlwind, Nightingale, Manifesto, and Take a Chance with Me. And although his Roxy efforts granted him a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, it's only act one of this gentleman's illustrious and serpentine career. He was the lead guitarist with 801 and Quiet Sun, and side by side with his Roxy gig, has had a prolific solo career, amounting to a total of over 15 albums, both alone and in tandem with a slew of talented art rock pals, including another Discograffiti luminary, legendary Os Mutantes main man Sergio Diaz. His production work, a veritable mountain in itself, includes John Cale's Fear, Split Ends, Second Thoughts, Nina Hagen's Revolution Ballroom, Antonio Vega's Oceano de Sol, the David Gilmour records On an Island and Rattle That Lock, and Pink Floyd's The Endless River. His session work includes guitar pyrotechnics on a few tracks from Brian Eno's stunning debut, Here Come the Warm Jets, as well as guitar and production assistance on Eno's Punch in the Nuts follow-up, Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. His memoir, Revolution to Roxy, will be out March 22nd through Wordsworth Publishing. To all you soldiers of sound out there in Discograffitiville, consider this your marching orders. Will you please then don your bedazzled, bug-eyed eyewear in deferential tribute to a man who's been there and done that so many times over he must get dizzy just thinking about it all. Will you please welcome the great Phil Manzanera?
Wow. How can I follow that? I feel quite exhausted.
That's the end of the show. That's it.
Thanks. And goodbye.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. You know, it's infrequent that before I start a show that my heart is hammering in my chest. So I'm throwing it out there because once I say it, it's gone. You know, I was doing jumping jacks, a plank. I was meditating. That's the esteem to which I hold you.
Very kind of you. Very kind of you.
So happy Valentine's Day. And more importantly, happy 65th anniversary.
Wow, 65th.
You know what happened 65 years ago today?
No.
65 years ago today, you fled Cuba during the 1959 revolution.
You're right. Yeah, sorry. At my age, you get the stats wrong, yeah. I've never thought of that one, but yeah, so very cool.
Before we get into the actual interview, let me give you just three bullet points that will sum up what you mean to me. I know you're something of a teetotaler, or at least to some extent, so take this particular story with a grain of salt. So the first night that I ever did LSD, and I'm not an acid head by any means, but the very first night, it was an incredible life-changing experience, was the night that my friend put on the first Roxy Music album and the second one. So I'm sitting in his room in the attic of his house, and during the Bogus Man, and I'll never forget this, I'm watching question marks dancing all around the room. And by the way, that night, I fell asleep to Sister Ray. So that's the kind of teenager I was. And then the next day, the very first thing I did was I went to the neighborhood record store, Al Wolk Records. I bought the first five records. And or they were CDs, of course. And then I was a senior in high school. I went into school that whole week. I was thrusting not just schoolmates, but acquaintances, not even people I knew. I was thrusting headphones onto their head and making them listen to Amazona. Okay, so that's the first story. Second is, as a music obsessive, I'm always looking for an oh my God music discovery that produces an almost Kundalini-like effect, chills up and down the spine. You have so many of them, but I'll never forget the day I first heard Prairie Rose. And I felt a gratitude for its existence, especially when it crescendos into the end, the round that happens at the end with the lap steel, I believe, is just so unbelievably amazing. And again, I was 18 and just felt this flush of gratitude before I even knew what gratitude was or had even really any conscious acknowledgement of it. And I'll wrap this up quick. This was never intended initially to be a guest-oriented show. The very first guest we ever had on the show, we did Roxy Music.
Wow, that's great. Well, so, what can I say? I mean, what you experienced was what I experienced, really, is the power of music, which I still, to this day, it's just part of my life. You know, we know music helps you mentally with the fabric of your life. It has resonance. That's what's wonderful about music. And it continues to. And luckily, it continues with all the people who were in Roxy to start with. We're all still doing exactly what we set out to do when I first met them in 1972, was just to be in a world of music. Regardless, you know, it's nice that people liked it and everything, but we just all immediately started doing lots of different things. And right at this moment, you know, Brian Eno is doing something completely different. I'm doing something completely different. Andy Mackay is doing something. Paul Thompson, they're all in their houses and places still doing what we were doing. You know, even though we came together as a band, it was more like a collective, I think, than a traditional band. Because it's wonderful that with the benefit of hindsight, I can make sense of what the hell happened, you know, which is great.
Yeah. And, you know, reading your memoir, you know, I always picture you as the guy with, you know, the bug eyes, with the, you know, the crazy glasses. And it's amazing that there's a lot of your story that dispels all of that, because when I look at the back cover of the first Roxy Music album, and especially you on Top of the Pops, I think I'm looking at, you know, a crazed lunatic, and you know, in the best way.
Yeah.
And yet, reading your memoir, it's like that was an afterthought. It wasn't even your decision. And you seem like a very civilized gentleman, not at all like...
Not a space cadet.
Not a space cadet at all. You know, either way, insanely talented, but, you know, a posh gentleman. All right, so the episode rule today is, you know, I'm playing Beat the Clock. I got my eye on the clock here. Typically, we do fetishistically in-depth discographical trawls, but the wonderful Carice had informed me this was going to be just a straight interview for 30 minutes. I said, 30 minutes? That's insane. I need at least 45. And she said, okay, 45, not a minute over. So for the purposes of extreme truncation, if we may, we'll focus on, especially in light of the memoir, your beginnings as a professional musician, your initial 5 years in Roxy Music, and the beginning of your solo career. And sure. Before we kick off, I just want to say your book is fantastic. And so I'll structure the interview around a few anecdotes that really popped out at me that I'll place.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so first, your holy shit moment of creative epiphany is a combination of your mom's Spanish guitar and Charlie Lindzell's Chuck Berry riffs, right?
Yeah.
So I want to ask first, it looks like your mom's Spanish guitar was nylon stringed by the looks of it.
Yeah.
Do you still prefer the bottom end warmth of nylon over steel to this day?
I think in general, I would say yes, because, I mean, that particular guitar made in Havana in 1957, you just pluck the strings and it just evokes Latin America and Cuba in 1957. I mean, it invokes boleros. It invokes the traditions of Latin American, South American songs, all crystallized in a tone where you just have to hit the string. It's not here with me today because I'm up in London in my studio, but in my little garden shed studio in West Sussex, you'd see it in the back of me. It's with me every day. It's like one of my friends that accompanies me.
Is it too precious for you to use, or do you reach for it in specific circumstances?
I reach for it almost every day because I have to turn on the heating next to it. So I reach for it and give it a little bit of love. But it's a beautiful thing. It's small. It's delicate. It just takes me right back to my mother. It takes me back to Havana in that period. It takes me back to a sort of colorful life as opposed to England before I went to Cuba in 1957, which to me was in black and white. It takes me to the tropics. It takes me to the warmth and the personality of speaking Spanish and going to school in Cuba for 3 years.
When you enter into Roxy Music, a band not really known for their boleros, I know you talk about sneaking in your early influences right under the carpet on the first several Roxy Music records. Was it a relief eventually to not have to have that duality of Latin versus rock? Once the mid-70s hit and the band went on hiatus and you were able to spread your wings and connect all those dots?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the first thing I did when I started doing a solo album in 1975 was to do a track with Robert Wyatt in Spanish with this cascading ostinato type of echo, which I tried to infiltrate into Roxy all the time to get more rhythm into the thing. And it was a coded sort of message. They didn't really realize what I was doing.
Frontera? That's the song, right? Frontera?
Yeah, Frontera. It's called Frontera.
First of all, I want to say, anyone who's not heard your first solo album, it's not only a masterpiece, but it's such a collection of great players. It's like an all-star thing that is, you know, you got to really take in to believe. And the greatest thing about your first touching of the Latin thing is that it was touched with an art rock sensibility because Robert just strung a bunch of disconnected Spanish words together.
That's right. When I said, okay, well, actually, he did know some Spanish because he'd spent some time in Barcelona and he was, you know, into that thing. But I said, how did you do the lyrics? Because I didn't know you knew enough Spanish. He said, I just opened a dictionary, took a series of phrases. And the thing about, if you know about Soft Machine and Robert White, is that they were very much into Dada, the Dada art movement. And it was so sort of Dada, you just get random phrases, you stick it all together, and it made some bizarre story. You know, some of it is not grammatically correct, which some Spanish people said, what the hell's that about? And then they just sort of thought, oh, hang on, this is like a very surreal type of lyric. But Robert is such a sort of treasure and artist. He knew what he was doing in a sort of Dada-ish way. But I loved it. And of course, he was one of my heroes growing up. You know, so I wanted to play with him on that straight away. You know.
Okay, step one in your career, you wind up founding the most important band of your entire career, Drag Alley Beach Bob.
Yeah, when I was 9, I begged my parents to send me to a boarding school in England from Caracas, Venezuela, because I could hear pop music and rock music on the BBC World Service. So I've got to go to England. And to be fair, my brother was out of school already. He's 8 years older than me. So it wasn't like I was just being sent like a lonely waif off back to Dickensian England or something. So when you get to school there, there's other boys who can play instruments and you want to form a band. And, you know, when I'd been in Venezuela, a lot of American colleges used to come over and play Buddy Holly and stuff like that. And we knew that, you know, about the Beach Boys and stuff. So, you know, hence, that just shows sort of in my mind what I was saying, the Drag Alley Beach Mob, you know, what was like, what? That's just, and so we had a little sort of band at school.
Love it. Yeah, I love, you know, you actually say in your book, don't ask. And I thought, well, yeah. I have to ask.
Yeah, I mean, obviously those names that we all had to start with of our first groups are like cringeworthy, you know, like the next one, which was Pooh and the Ostrich Feather.
I love that, too. I think these are great names.
I didn't even think of that. That was this guy called Ian McDonald, who was at school with us, who became a famous journalist. Unfortunately, he's dead now, but he wrote a brilliant book on the Beatles, a seminal book called Revolution in the Head.
Possibly the best book on the Beatles. Probably the best book.
Yeah. He was a bit older than us. He was the elder brother of Bill, my bass player and accomplice. And we just obeyed him. You know, he just said, you should do this. You should check out Spirit, the band. You should check out the Velvet Underground, the first album. You know, we were right there with everything, all the stuff in the USA in the 60s, all the hip things, systems, music, everything. You know, it's because of Ian, really. He was like our mentor, you know.
Now, you're obviously focused and talented and you have good taste. But obviously, everyone says it's who you know, not what you know. And so talk to me about, from your perspective now, how fortunate were you to have crossed paths and befriended such a panoply of art rock royalty from the start? Or were you just steadfast and locked in on proving to your mom that you were going to be a successful rock guitarist? How much was luck? How much was focus?
It was totally luck, totally chance. It's just being in the right place at the right time is a bit of a cliche, but it is true. But you have to have been prepared. So this whole idea of like you need 10,000 hours of practice to get good in anything, you know, so, you know, all those days and nights spent sitting on my bedroom in Venezuela or in Hawaii or in London, like picking away at a guitar and all that meant that when the opportunity came, if everything was going to happen, I was ready. I'd done the prep. And as they say, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. So there is something in that.
Action! And now, an important message from Don Bowles.
Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for District Attorney of Los Angeles who has over a decade of experience successfully defending those falsely accused of crimes. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who is dedicated to ending mass incarceration. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who co-created and produced the televised freakout public access show known as The Three Geniuses, which the LA Weekly dubbed the most intentionally psychedelic show on television. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who is an accomplished phototheremist. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who now has a record label with punk rock legend and all-around weirdo Don Bowles. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who was not only the features editor at Hustler Magazine, but also Larry Flint's editorial point man for his First Amendment lawsuit against the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon. If you believe in liberty, justice, and the American way, vote for Dan Kapelowitz. Stick it to the man. Vote for Dan. Dan Kapelowitz.
I'm Dan Kapelowitz, and I approve this message.
You know, you could have wound up a successful guitarist, but been in a band such as Caravan, who are not doing these giant reunions 50 years later, but have a, you know, a solid critical standing, but, you know, maybe having to augment, you know, I'm using them as an example, but it's not the most commercial type of music that you went after, but yet you still wound up being commercially successful.
I mean, you can't predict what's going to happen. I answered an ad in a rock paper, guitarist wanted. I went to this place and there was Brian Eno, Brian Ferry, Andy Mackay, and I knew straight away that these guys were special. I knew there was something, they were older than me, and I thought, wow, they've been at university. Brian and Andy were teaching. One was an art teacher, one was a music teacher. They had a car. They had bank accounts. You know, they had borrowed money to buy a little PA. These guys, they were just like so ahead. And then I spent hours talking to them and realized we had lots of interesting commons in film and art and stuff like that. But I also realized that they weren't musically particularly proficient, but the unifying factor was the Velvet Underground. You know, Velvet Underground, art, simple chords.
Carole King. Wasn't your audition a Carole King song? I mean, that is so far from what you guys wound up doing.
It was so far from what the band before, Quiet Sunday, I was doing prog rock in like funny time signatures, 17-8 and then one bar of 13-8. It was just such a wonderfully liberating thing. I said, there's only two chords here. What am I going to do? I just go off exploring sounds and textures. And then I understood this is about creating a musical context for this guy with a weird voice who's like pretty unique and is pretty good looking, but it's weird as well. And you've got Eno with all his wonderful art school background from, you know, the same, I didn't know at the time, the same tutor as Pete Townsend. You know, I mean, it's a different branch of art school, of artwork, of conceptual kind of art to Brian Ferry, which is very fine art and stuff like that.
What was your first impression of these guys? You guys are a bunch of art rock dogs. So exactly how were you sniffing each other out? Do you remember, were you testing them with certain cultural cues and were they testing you back?
Well, no, I remember talking about films with Brian, the Humphrey Bogart films, which you can see, you know, Hollywood 40s, 50s, well, even early 30s, that look, the whole idea that rock and roll was about image and music. When you get the two coming together, you could be super successful. And one without the other, you can be successful, but not as successful. But the context that you play in and the conceptual idea of what you're doing is so important. If you understand that, you can go quickly in a certain direction and give it all you've got. But if you spend ages searching, and let's be frank, you know, Bowie spent 5 years searching before he got to Ziggy Stardust, which Ziggy Stardust was released on exactly the same day as the first Roxy Music album. And the week before, we had been supporting him at the pub in Croydon, and he liked the look of us and said, would you like to come and play with me? And he was already on the ascent. He was wonderfully generous, and somehow Bowie and Roxy became the leaders of this new wave that happens sort of every 5 years in some, to a certain extent, used to.
It's still forward thinking, because when I look at glam from that time, most of it, I think, is overrated. This is just me personally. I think T-Rex is overrated because T-Rex is Chuck Berry with some boots on. And then Mötley Hoople was a denim-clad band that threw on some platform shoes and called it a day. You guys, when I look at you playing Lady Tron on the Old Grey Whistle Test, when I watch you on Top of the Pops, especially with Virginia Plain, it still seems like music from the future. And one of the reasons why, and I'm so curious about this, because I love Avalon, and you know, I love your later stuff, but the dividing point for me is around album 4, where things are still great, but they're not blowing my mind out of my skull. And the reason is because, for example, 2HB, we're taking that Hollywood fixation and that shared mutual love of film, and we're subverting it into an almost aqueous-like underwater environment. Whereas later on, it was just what you see is what you get, the crooner, the soft music, that subversion's not there anymore. Is that why you connect mainly with the first three?
It is why I connect with the first three. But one thing that when I talked about glam rock with David Bowie, he said, the thing is, Phil, there was high glam and low glam. And we were high glam, and there was a lot of, you know, low glam. But if you look, you know, with hindsight now, if I look back at the whole Roxy 8 albums, I can see the transition from the initial point, which was a band or a collective, if you like, that gradually disintegrated, basically, but on the other hand, was intent on doing something different with every album, not repeating itself. And there was a very short time to record these albums because you had to go out on tour and stuff. So it was what it was. There was no extra tracks. There's just none. It was just what it was. And we had to get the hell out of there. Sometimes come back on tour and finish the album, go back up. So when you're doing so much, so we're talking about 80 or 90 tracks over the whole career, there's going to be winners and losers. And one of the reasons for that is time, the time factor of recording and creatively coming up with stuff. But the other thing is the method, the process, the Roxy process of work was very different to other bands and other singer-songwriters. It wasn't like you see McCartney in the film just recently, and he sits down the long and winding road and you hear it, and he's a proper singer-songwriter, a melody, and he's got some words, and someone says, oh, why didn't you change that? Maybe change a tiny bit. No, Roxy, it was just like, do all the instrumental music, and then Brian would try and write a top line and come up with some lyrical idea with the music already all done. We would create this musical context for him.
Did that only work with him? I mean, after you split off and did your millions of other works, did you bring that technique with you at all, or was that only endemic to Brian Ferry?
Brian Ferry was one of the few people who could do that. The last two albums that I've done with Tim Finn, who was in Crowded House and Split Ends, he insisted that he could do work that way. And I just sent him music, and I said, I'll change bits if you want. He said, no, I just want to write to exactly what you did. And he did it brilliantly, proving he's a proper songwriter anyway. But he showed he could do that method as well. And, you know, I think to a certain extent, Eno brought that method to Bowie as well. And you could hear that from Low onwards, there's certain amounts of that thing. But that way of working wasn't like conventional songwriting, although obviously David Bowie could write in a conventional way, because look at the 5 years before and all the hundreds of songs that he was writing all the time, getting
craft. He was utilizing cut-up techniques around the time you guys came out, so still unconventional in a conventional framework.
Yeah, all power to him, yeah. But we couldn't do the other way. We just couldn't. So it was like, sometimes we'd be in the studio, like for the track Love is the Drug, no idea what was going to go on top or anything. And Brian took it away. He came back and we'd just sort of sit there and say, okay, send him out to sing. And he'd go out and sing. And we'd go, shit. We'd all clap and say, fuck, it's a single, it's a hit. And just at that moment, at the very last moment, those things happened in a sort of very exciting way, but it could have been a disaster. And some of the tracks were. No. It's too late. It's got to come.
But I love that you're such a tough critic of your own work. I mean, you're obviously someone who's examining this stuff, because for many years, there's one particular friend of mine who I would have arguments with. And he's like, no, I'm telling you, Siren is part of the classic five. And I said, it's kind of, but it's the first four. And you're saying it's the first three. So where does country?
Maybe three and a half, maybe.
Okay, because I always saw Stranded in Country Life as being not incredibly different, but then the songwriting is fantastic on Siren. I'm not assailing it as a work. The vibe, the approach and the intention are slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, by that stage, you know, everything was changing. We were all changing. We'd all done solo albums. You know, what did we want from a Roxy album? It was confusing. But it had to be done. And then, of course, there was a big split after Siren for 2 or 3 years where I did the 801 Live and Split Ends and John Cale and all that. And then we came back together again, you know, for Manifesto and did the last three, ending with Avalon, which is in America is the most successful album, and it's the one that people know and love the best, that really is more like a Brian Ferry solo album, really.
I didn't even come around to that one until many years later. And it's interesting, the progression, you know, I always, from 30,000 feet, try to look at the arc of a band. And the arc of you guys over the course of 10 years is we're gently and gradually, at first, not even noticeably, we're pulling out slowly the Subversion.
Yeah.
That top line that Brian brings is still there.
Yeah, not intentionally pulling out Subversion, but, you know, this desire to be innovative the whole time is difficult. You know, creatively, to do 8 albums was a miracle, quite frankly, that we did 8 albums in 10 years, you know.
I'm going to make the case, and I have for many years, that the first side of your first album is the greatest side of a debut album that's ever been released. I mean, I think it's probably the best debut album of all time. It's in the top 10 for sure. But that first side especially, every song is a manifesto. They're all different. And plus, I know it's the American version, so it's slightly bastardized. But the mission statement of you and me, just we two, got to search for something new. I mean, to me, that's Roxy Music. That line is Roxy Music. Just we two, to me, is Roxy Music and the audience. I don't know what Roxy intended, but that's what I pick up.
No, and you're absolutely right. There's a lot of mission statement in that.
Acid, speed, and rampant infidelity. And that's before the band recorded a single note. Fleetwood Mac's got nothing on the Mamas and the Papas. I don't care if you love them or not, if they're in your wheelhouse or far, far outside of it, the Michelle Phillips Interview of a Lifetime series coming March 22nd on Discograffiti is absolutely riveting. I promise you, you've never heard anything quite like it. Michelle, you want to take them out?
It's hard to be really candid about so many disturbing things. And you've made me feel that I can do that. And I am very grateful to you for giving me that opportunity to talk without feeling like I'm afraid of what I'm saying.
Save the date, March 22nd. Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime. You won't know what hit you.
And the remake, remodel, the very first track, sums it all up. It does crystallize everything that Roxy was about. And, you know, that's a track that we played right up until our farewell tour, you know, 2 years ago, 50th anniversary tour in the States and everything, and still sounded great. Never touched, even though it's only got 3 chords, it's just crazy and wacky, you know.
Yeah. And that's another great thing about you guys is during Remake Remodel, you guys are asked to really solo out your specific ingredients that you're bringing into this thing. And somehow, because you're very forcible musical personalities, you know, there very well could not have been a blend. There very well could have been, like, yeah, I think Cream are the most overrated band of the 60s. It could have been 5 guys masturbating into their own particular black holes. But it wasn't. You wound up bringing your individual things and sublimating them at the same time. And I don't know, to me, that's a magic trick.
Well, I sometimes say it's the fact that the sum of our inadequacies created a total Roxy sound. And all the things that we couldn't do limited us, but brought us together and made us supportive of the whole thing. You know, it's like cooking a soup or something. All the ingredients, you know, and then you taste it. That's perfect. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be simple, but it can be delicious, you know.
And by the way, one of the ingredients, having departed in 73, there's a picture in your book that, what an amazing moment to have captured in a photograph, Brian Eno waving goodbye after the very last gig you guys played on July 2nd, 1973 in York. So I'm curious, obviously talking about the Subversion sort of leaking out of the balloon, as it were. I know some of the friends I've had in my life, and I've seen them as creative collaborators, yes, but they're friends. So sometimes their greatness has kind of snuck up on me and took me by surprise, because we came up together as boys. So yeah. I'm curious, did you have any sense? Obviously, you knew he'd go on to do great things, but did you have any sense that he'd go on to become you know, the great Eno in all caps?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, I knew he was special, but it wasn't like we were like working together. I mean, we shared an apartment even after he left. You know, we shared an apartment. We were friends. I wanted to make sure that he was all right. I found the studio for his first solo album. We co-wrote the first track, Needles in the Camel's Eye, together. My mum's house on an old 10-pound piano, you know.
Wait, wasn't that him going like this on your whammy bar while you're playing?
Yes. Yeah. I'm playing, he's just going, no, 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 no.
It's like one of the great guitar figures of all time.
Because, it, you know, it's easy to forget, but in those days, computers didn't exist. There was a fuzz box and a wah-wah pedal and an echo unit. If you wanted something weird, you had to do it organically. You had to put tape over things. You had to, without the studio managing notice, put screws in the piano, you know, to make it do funky things, you know, which you would have been chucked out of the studio if they found us. Or getting broomsticks and putting the 24-track tape around it and taking outside the door and all sorts. You had to do it yourself. It was what we call in England a Heath Robinson method of British, like, we'll find a way to do it. What is there in this room that we can use to make a funny sound or whatever? So, you know, Eno was in that tradition, and I enjoyed all that.
By the way, we have 6 minutes before Carissa's making me get off. No, it's okay. I'm like skipping frantically through these questions and leaving a bunch behind, and that's fine. So I think that it feels, and here's my theory, and I know he's your friend, so I'm not looking for dirt. But, you know, these things play out in my mind like I lived them.
Yeah.
I feel so connected to your history.
Yeah.
The tenseness that comes with Eno's involvement in the group present day, that, you know, when you tried at a modern day regrouping of the original lineup to create that new studio material, and you very eloquently described this. And it seems to me that my theory is, it's down to an almost knee-jerk schoolboy sibling rivalry thing that, even though as an adult, Eno has that classic evolved type personality, once he steps in a room with his boy mates, he reverts right back to the ostrich feather wearing freaky young man that is incapable of grasping the adult that he became. And so can't do that smooth oblique strategies thing with you guys because you guys are mates. Is that, am I?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the psychology of it was hilarious, really, looking back on it, because, you know, the intent was there, right? Let's all get back together again with the original producer and let's see what happens. The minute we got into like having a cup of tea, I think, you know, the bubble came out saying, this is never going to work. You know, for all our heads, this is a good, you know, probably a bad idea. How do we get out of this without, like, with the least possible? And of course, the music was rubbish, quite frankly. I mean, I've got it on my computer here, but, you know, no one will ever hear it.
You may be right, but you're also a harsh critic, and that much I know. Yeah. All right, so I have a few more questions that are kind of disconnected here. What is your single greatest accomplishment in your career, in your eyes, not the public's, and your single biggest professional regret?
Well, my biggest achievement is the fact that I am free. I wanted to be free. I became a musician because I wanted to be free and I wanted to meet other people and be sociable and work with anyone I wanted to. And thank God, I don't have a manager. I'm not tied to a record deal. I can do whatever. I realized that owning the means of production was the key to it all way back in 1976. So I wouldn't have to go and ask permission to do music. And that's good enough for me. I do music. Most of it's not successful. It keeps me happy. I just want to be happy and do music. So that's what I think is my, thank you, God, my biggest thing that's happened over this time. And what was the other question?
Your single biggest regret, professional.
I don't have any big regrets, actually. You know, it is what it is. And I'm looking forward. You know, that's why it's great to put this memoir down, to sort of get it down on book for my cousins and my kids and all that. This is what happened. But I'm always looking forward. You know, we're doing some gigs in 2 weeks' time, me, Andy, and Paul Thompson, experimental music in a tiny little club in Soho, 65 people a night, 3 nights. And it's going to be challenging. I've got no idea how it's going to turn out. And that's, hey, that's what we do. It could be a disaster. It could be great.
That's like Pooh and the ostrich feather. So
yeah,
two questions from the main thing, Brian Ferry and Roxy Music Fan Club group on Facebook. Manny from Glasgow, who's been a Roxy fan since August 24th, 1972, when he saw Top of the Pops, asks, when you auditioned for Roxy Music, were you aware of any other guitarist that had auditioned? And did you envision at that point that you'd be as huge as you are?
I had no idea anyone else was auditioning or doing anything. That's why I was surprised when I failed the audition and they gave the gig to Dave O'List, who, to be fair, I was a big fan of Dave O'List. And I thought, how could I compete with Dave O'List? The guy's genius. You know, I'd seen him play with the Nice at Albert Hall and stuff. And what was the other part of it?
And did you envision you guys being as huge as you were at that point?
No, not at all. No, I mean...
And Reg Royal, I'm sorry, I got to jump because Carice is going to slit my throat. Yeah. Reg Royal, the admin of the group, asks, here's a question we all want to know on here. Are there any plans to tour with Roxy Music again?
Absolutely no plans at all. No plans at all. Yeah, and that was it. It was a great way to go out.
Okay, and finally, to those out there who feel that they could never hope to make tons and tons of money following a decidedly uncommercial, naughty, time-signatured art rock muse, let's talk about, for a second, No Church in the Wild and K-Scope, because that is unbelievable. A tiny little sample winds up opening a Kanye West record and makes you more money as a slowed-down sample than your entire 50 years as a member of Roxy Music. Which is, by the way, illustrative of your entire career of just incredible talent and fortune and good luck commingled.
You could never predict these things. I think if you just stay calm, stay in your lane, just, you know, I just want to play music, just do good work, and things happen. You know, that is the secret. I'd never chase fame or fortune or anything like that. And out of the blue... Yeah, something that I did without even thinking the night before going into a studio, played a little riff, watching the TV or something, recorded the next day, 35 years later, finds itself, you know, on a track that wins a Grammy, is in The Great Gatsby. And, you know, there's this guy in New York, 88 Keys, who finds an old vinyl, takes it to them. It's as if someone said from on high, take that for all the shit that, you know, that you're worried or anything. Here, have that. Go on. You know, thank you.
One final question, and then I'll let you go. There's a theory in quantum physics that every crossroads where something happens and something doesn't happen, both those things happen. And so a thread branches off and there's an alternate reality where that thing happens as well. In the world where Dave O'List winds up working out for Roxy Music splendidly, what happens with Phil Manzanera? What wound up happening?
Phil Manzanera goes to King's College University, London, studies Latin American studies, and becomes a sort of history tour guide around South America and the history of Mexico and the Spanish conquistadors and all that kind of thing. That's kind of nice. I like that.
You know what? I think no matter what would wind up happening with you, you'd be just fine with it.
Yeah. As long as I'm happy, hey.
And you know what? I bet that's the character trait that you could probably mainly attribute to your success.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, just keep going.
You deserve every last bit of it. And your memoir, Revolución to Roxy, it comes out March 22nd through Wordsworth Publishing. A companion music CD of the same name is going to be released April 12th via Expression Records and includes 5 previously unreleased songs. Phil, it's beyond an honor to have you here. You know, I'm absolutely gobsmacked, like I said, and thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you for loving the music.
All right, that about does it. Stay tuned because this Friday, March 22nd, brings upon us, finally, part one of our mind-blowing Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime series, kicking off on Sunday with Getting Kinda Itchy, Mamas and Papas biographer Richard Campbell's special Patreon private tier drumroll prequel, detailing how the various threads of the group finally coalesced. And then Monday's massively expanded, early release, ad-free, ultimate director's cut of the premiere episode. I got a family to feed here, so I ain't messing around. When I say massively expanded, I really, really mean it. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Phil Manzanera, Carice Yatter and Hired Gun Media, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the higher echelons of demented art rock finery is to leap headfirst into, of course, Pavement's Spiral Stairs, raiding the entirety of Roxy Music's catalog. That's episode 8. Kula Shaker and the albums that shaped them. That's episode 139. The Rise and Fall of Jim Gordon with biographer Joel Selvin. Episode 138. Badasses or Brassholes, My Blood, Sweat, and Tears Battle Royale with Fernando Perdomo. That's episode 137. My interview with Mojo Magazine's editor John Mulvey. That's 114 and 115. Vashti Bunyan reading the entirety of her discography. That's 103 and 104. My interview with Sergio Diaz about the early Os Mutantes. That's 86 and 87. Jonathan Rado on Todd Rundgren. That's 37 and 40. Anthony Fantano rating The Velvet Underground, that's 32 and 33. Don Randy rates David Axelrod, that's number 17. Peter Gabriel, number 13. Cocteau Twins, number 3. And Pink Floyd, episodes 1 and 2. Get busy listening or get busy dying. We'll see you next week for Michelle Phillips, the interview of a lifetime. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography.
Osiris.